Well, I'd like to welcome my guests who are going to help me look at all of this on this spotlight. Bob Gill, producer of The Great NHS Heist out of London. And Lynn Bedolpik, former member of British Parliament, also out of London. Welcome both of you to the program. Well, let's start this with Bob. Bob, one of the indications of deteriorating lifestyle, of course, is the NHS and what has happened there. And you've done a lot of research on it. Let's start from there. What happened? How did we get where we are compared to the UK that we once knew?
Thank you. Yeah, well, the most recent assault on public services in general, the latest phase, was commenced after the financial crash in 2008. We've had a decade of austerity, and that austerity has been used by the government as cover for what has been effectively wage theft from public service workers. And across the NHS, this means a 25 to 30% reduction in real terms incomes of doctors and nurses and NHS staff in general. But this is part of a bigger plan, which has been the gradual privatization of our healthcare system and repurposing it into an American-style system. And as I said, this really took off in 2012 with the Health and Social Care Act, which is a major privatization act. And, you know, the patients and staff are paying the price for deliberate government policy to destabilize our health service and hand it over to private capital.
Huh. And Limbit, if you agree with Bob and what he's just said, why haven't we seen more of an uproar from British people, especially regarding NHS? Because as an American, I can tell you definitely we are very far from what you guys used to have in the States. And it was always something that we admired. But now looking at it, what is happening right now, it's quite unbelievable. I mean, your take.
On the first part, I think that he's basically right when he describes the gradual privatization of the NHS. We see a situation where you have to pay for more and more things, and fewer things are available on that health service. Why? Partly because the British population is getting older, but also because there's an ideological move away from the original purpose of the NHS. On the second point you make, I would give you a more strategic answer than the tactical question. We are now bankrupt as a country, and the Conservatives are in government now. If Labour get in charge next time, they're not going to make things better. What we're seeing now is more of an NHS like in the United States, where if you're poor, you die young. If you're rich, you die old. And there'll be excuses for that. They will blame people's lifestyle choices. They will say that individuals need to protect themselves on the way through life. So let me summarize it in this way. When it comes down to the UK now, the NHS is an allegory. It's a metaphor for the whole problem in the country. We're going bust, and the rich will be fine, but the poor will not.
Okay, what about that, Bob? Limbit says bankrupt and going bust. On the one hand, that can be said. On the other hand, what our correspondent actually reported when she was talking to Londoners on the ground there was basically that they felt that the people were just not being prioritized. Because at the same time that on the one hand, the government says that they don't have money, but we see, depending on the situation, depending on what they want to fund, especially when it comes to weapons and war, there always seems to be money. Your take?
Yeah. So, you know, the bust is being applied to the majority of the population, but there's a boom for the finance sector. The bankers are enjoying a free gift of an interest rate hike. As you mentioned, the Ukraine war, money seems to be no object. You know, we've had a huge, massive financial sector bailout for which the public are now paying. There is a sort of an economic apartheid applied to this country. But let's not forget the recent past, which was the pandemic. We had a hugely expensive pandemic response, which was largely privatized. And a lot of that money went to companies like big accountancy firms such as Deloitte and the outsourcing giant Serco. We spent, I believe it was $37 billion, for which there is no lasting, impact on the health service. That money was totally squandered. So if we are going bankrupt, there seems to be plenty of money to be spent and wasted down the drain, but isn't getting invested in public services. And we know if you spend and invest in healthcare, that returns income to the economy. That doesn't end up in a tax haven or avoiding UK taxes, but that gets redirected back into the economy, not only through the spending of the workforce within the NHS, but you're restoring people of working age back into work. So it's very short-sighted. It's economic self-harm, which is being practiced by our government.
Limit, do you think the roots of this economic situation right now of the UK goes back to the austerity measures that we talked about earlier? Or do the roots actually go back to the Margaret Thatcher reign and the introduction of the whole neoliberal agenda? I mean, your assessment of where this all started.
The issue of where we stand here, and your question is very insightful, is that it all began in 1979. Until then, we had a fairly socialist environment, to be honest with you. Harold Wilson, Callaghan, older viewers will remember those names. But from 1979, greed was good. If you couldn't help yourself, nobody else much was going to help you. Margaret Thatcher's great achievement was not just destroying the country, but also destroying the Labour Party. And now we have a Labour Party under Keir Starmer, which is almost the same as the old Conservative Party. So you're right to ask that question. The great tragedy in our country now, as Bob has more or less implied, is that you don't have a choice. We're going to have a...
Okay, Limbit, I don't have the audio there from Limbit. Hopefully we can reestablish contact with Limbit. Let me cross back over to Bob. Well, Bob, looking at the situation, looking at the overall situation, Bob, and now you talked about the NHS and you also talked about the pandemic. I mean, where is this going then? During the pandemic, we saw across the world that people were grateful to the doctors, to the nurses who worked so hard. And then after the pandemic, basically, we'll use the UK for an example. A lot of the people felt that they turned their backs on them. And so we have seen strikes, industrial actions from senior doctors, junior doctors, radiologists, just across the board. I mean, your assessment of why that happened and the way it did, and where is it going?
So, yeah, the series of strikes that you mentioned are historic, the longest protracted strike action in the history of the NHS. And that is because, they bore the brunt of the response to the pandemic. We had this public show of support by the politicians clapping in the street and all the rest of it. But the reality was when it came to pay restoration, they weren't interested. So the strike action was a last resort. We know that money is no object when it comes to diverting money to the banks, the financial sector, these big four accountancy firms. We've seen money splashed on them, but not reinvested in the health service. And the people who still work in the NHS can see their colleagues leaving, either retiring early or emigrating or just giving up healthcare altogether. And they know that without serious steps to address the pay issues, the workforce crisis will just get worse and the quality of care for patients will suffer. There will be mass preventable harm and death. But what I think the unions and the workers are failing to point out is the bigger objective, which is to make it a skid row service and expand the private sector. And overall, the cost to the economy will be larger. So we'll end up paying more either through direct taxation or out of our pockets with insurance cover. We will be paying more as individuals, more as a society, and be getting worse outcomes, which is what happens in America now. So we're actually copying the most expensive and dystopian system on the planet, and we'll all be paying financially and also in health terms.
Well, let me just jump in, Bob, what you just said. So why then would those in power use this worst model to copy it when they know that it will not benefit the overall society?
Well, you have to look at their own conflicts of interest. So many of our political class are certainly, they're ideologically wedded to this idea of the market being the solution to everything, despite no evidence. But we know that MPs hold directorships, have shareholdings, have other interests, and often through the revolving door, when they're no longer in power, go up and cash up on the policies that they introduced while they were in power. So there are financial and ideological conflicts of interest which do not represent what is in the public interest.
Okay, well, Limbet, sorry, we had some audio difficulties. I want you to repeat your point. You were talking about all of this going back to 1979 and the reign of former Prime Minister Thatcher. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, first of all, I hope you can hear me now.
I can.
And let me fundamentally make a point. I'm 1 kilometer from Westminster right now, and I cannot even get a good signal. That's how bad the infrastructure in the UK is now. Turning to what I was saying before, in 1979, Margaret Thatcher got elected with a big majority, and that majority kept increasing. But from then on, nothing really went right. Instead of serving the public, the government decided it should rule the public. And she did not just ruin the country. She did not just destroy the country. She destroyed the Labour Party, the main opposition in this country. So these days, as I was saying before, we don't have a choice. We have strong Conservative or weak Conservative. Keir Starmer is no real difference compared to the Conservatives, because they all talk about the same things. And Bob is absolutely right in the things he said. I won't repeat them. Fundamentally, we are now in a situation where Britain doesn't have a choice electorally, but we are destroying ourselves by stupid policies, by bad economics, and by a situation where we've got relatively low unemployment, but very high poverty. 15 million people in poverty in this country. We've become a semi-second world country, and that is a tragedy, and an avoidable one at that.
Well, Bob, your perspective on what can be done. I mean, you talked about the challenges that, especially in the medical sector, that people are facing. We talked about why the government would not address these issues, because it's better for the society. So in a society where actually industrial strikes are not usually a norm, it's not like, for example, France, but we're seeing more and more of these industrial actions. Where do you see this going? What is it going to take to change this for these employers in the health sectors and other sectors?
I think there has to be a public awakening in terms of realizing, unfortunately, our political class is no longer serving our interests. I think the striking healthcare workers need to make the broader point on the assault on our healthcare system from, you know, multinational American corporations, and, you know, how profit extraction will take priority over service provision. And educate the public in terms of the economic benefits of having universal comprehensive healthcare, which is publicly funded and publicly delivered. It's far more efficient, far less wasteful, doesn't introduce blatant conflict of interest and perverse incentives which are rife in the American system. So there has to be a public awakening. There has to be more, perhaps, direct action to make the politicians fearful of the public response when they finally realize that they've been hoodwinked and brainwashed and gaslighted into a dystopian system which will not serve the interest of the vast majority of the public.
Well, Limbet, what do you think? I mean, as increasingly more people strike in the UK, do you think the government will give in? Will they grant them their requests? Or what do you see happening?
Bob's outlined the immediate situation. My view is this. the Conservatives are trying desperately to stop the industrial action. One reason I'm sitting here in Victoria Station is because it's very difficult to get home at the moment. Victoria Station is right in the middle of London. Why is it so hard? Is because there's resistance to cooperating with government edicts. Turning to your direct question, what any government can do is declare peace for the workers. But there is no serious government in this country, present or future, that's planning to do that. They should be saying, we've caused a problem. We're sorry about the problem. We will pay you more, and we'll work together to fix it. And sadly, Keir Starmer, who could be the next prime minister, and Rishi Sunak, who is the current prime minister, they're not saying that. They declared war on the working classes, and nobody seems to want to stop that war. The only losers, really, are the British population and the credibility of the United Kingdom as a whole.
Well, Bob, do you see the overall economic situation in the UK improving, or will it just continue to deteriorate in the near future?
I think unless there is a political recalibration and change in direction, I can only see things getting worse as there's a constant upward transfer of wealth, a further divide in terms of inequality of financial status in this country, and more disastrous foreign policy and domestic policy, which is just seeing upward transfer of wealth. You know, the war in Ukraine seems to me an unwinnable war, a proxy war on behalf of the United States, which is draining not only Ukrainian lives, but taxpayer money from across Europe. So that seems to be a policy that is seriously backfiring. The economic sanctions we introduced on Russia have also backfired. We're now, you know, paying interest rates that are rising. These are all damaging the public, the vast majority of the public, and also transferring wealth. We have to reverse this transfer of upward wealth transfer and, you know, look into redistributive policies. And unless there's that fundamental change, I can't see our economic prospects improving.
Well, Limpet, if what Bob is saying actually pans out, I mean, what about the British people themselves? Do you see actually a situation deteriorating where there's public unrest because their leaders are not listening to them because of desperation? Or how do you assess the situation?
Bob's assessment is right, and I see it now. On Saturday, I was outside the BBC complaining in a demonstration, complaining about something called the ultra low emission zone. It's a stupid policy which is going to make it even harder for people to drive into central London if you have an old car. I'm beginning to see the signs of a revolution. It might not be the French Revolution, but the civil disobedience beginning now. Why? Because the public, especially the least wealthy, don't feel listened to. They don't feel they've got anyone to vote for, and nothing's really going to be fixed. There was a by-election in a place called Uxbridge, and the Conservatives are very unpopular. But one of these policies was so unpopular that they actually won because the Labour Party had an even more unpopular policy. So in one sentence, summarising what I think in terms of your question, we're going to see a disconnect, like Bob said, between the members of the public and the politicians, and that could eventually lead to civil unrest and further decline in the credibility of British politics, the further decline in the credibility of the United Kingdom on the world stage.
And on that note, I appreciate both of you being with me on the Spotlight. Bob Gill, producer of the great NHS Heist out of London, and Limpet Opic, former member of British Parliament, also out of London. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashmi, signing out for myself and other crew right here in Tehran. Thanks so much for being with us.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, how to remain steadfast, especially when looking at Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, it is such an honor to be here at your service, dear listeners, dear friends. In today's episode, we are talking about how to remain steadfast, especially when taking into consideration Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Now, from the title, you have already guessed, because it is quite clear that one of the things that we learn from Imam Hussein alayhi salam is this steadfastness. Now, to remain on the path of Islam and to really live an Islamic lifestyle, you know, we're going to have to be steadfast. Now, being steadfast means that, you know, despite trials or tribulations, despite challenges and despite difficulties that might arise in trying to be a good person, in trying to be an honorable individual, and in trying to live this beautiful Islamic lifestyle, that we will, despite all these things, we will continue to be steadfast and continue to live an Islamic lifestyle, right? So when we look at Imam Hussein alayhi salam and the land of Karbala and the 10th of Muharram and even the events leading up to the 10th of Muharram in the year 61 Hijri, where the Master of Martyrs himself was martyred and attained martyrdom, but also 72 of his companions, among others, were martyred for the cause of Allah, on the path of Allah, they remained steadfast throughout all of these challenges and these difficulties. And it is a believer who is faced with challenges, it is a mu'min, it is a faithful person who is faced with challenges in order to test their belief, right? And even the Holy Quran says, do you think that you will acclaim and you will attest to faith, but you won't be tested to that proclamation that you make that you are of the faithful? Now, of course, the reward of the faithful is great, and we call ourselves faithful. So should there not be a test in order to gauge whether we are faithful or not?
Why is my heart set on fire when I hear your name?
As-salamu alayk, ya Aba Abdullah.
Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about how to be steadfast, and that too when taking into consideration Imam Hussein alayhi salam. So as we said, if we want to live an Islamic lifestyle in an environment which is relatively, if not totally, un-Islamic, then we're going to have to be steadfast. We're going to have to remain strong and confident. And this is something that we ourselves need to understand, that the Islamic lifestyle that we have been prescribed by the Almighty Allah is a perfect lifestyle. It is a perfect order. And not only does it bring about bliss and prosperity and satisfaction and joy on a personal individual level, but it will also do the same on a family level, as well as a communal, community level, social level, as well as eventually the global level, which is the ultimate purpose. The ultimate purpose is to bring happiness and bring prosperity and bring bliss and tranquility to all of humanity. And so in order to live an Islamic lifestyle, because that's where it all starts, right, is the individuals in a society, in a community, in a family, living an Islamic lifestyle, Well, we're going to have to be steadfast on that Islamic lifestyle. And just like Imam Hussein alayhi salam has taught us, we are going to face challenges and we're going to face difficulties. But if we rely on the Almighty Allah, if we have faith in the Almighty Allah and we trust the Almighty Allah, then, of course, with a little bit of effort on our part, or perhaps a lot of effort and remaining steadfast, we will be able to live that Islamic lifestyle. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z. Don't forget to visit our website at parsetoday.ir/EN Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah and God bless you all.
But anyone stay here, won't be left tomorrow. You can save yourself tonight and go. Silence, fill the air. Imam Ali, peace be upon him, said, "The Lord Most High has chosen for us certain followers, Shiites, who assist us. If we are joyful, they are joyful. And if we are sorrowful and sad, they are sorrowful and sad."
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Representatives of religious minorities have met in the Iranian capital Tehran to condemn the desecration of Muslims' holy book Quran, saying that such a sacrilegious act is aimed at creating discord and division among followers of different religious beliefs. They condemned repeated desecrations of the Holy Quran and Islamic sanctities in Sweden, noting that the Swedish government is fully responsible for the consequences of provoking the sentiments of the Muslim world.
Such insults to Islamic sanctities are a perfect example of organized violence in a hostile move against 2 billion Muslims across the world, God-believing people and followers of divine religions. Desecration of religious sanctities is rejected in all faiths. The recent desecrations in Sweden is considered a heinous crime and is unacceptable.
The recurring incidents of the desecration of Islamic sanctities in Europe, particularly in Sweden and Denmark, have drawn outrage across the Muslim world in recent weeks, especially here in Iran. In the Iranian capital Tehran, demonstrators gathered in front of the Swedish embassy to protest against the sacrilegious move. Moreover, millions of people took to the streets in Tehran and other major cities after Friday prayers this week to voice their anger over the incidents in Sweden and Denmark.
The sincere plot hatched by the enemies of Islam is not limited only to this period of time. The enemies of divine religions have always tried to sow the seeds of discord among their followers. But they should know that followers of Islam and other divine religions are vigilant and will not allow such insulting acts to create division and discord among them, and they get even more united in the face of the enemies.
Any insult to religious sanctities and divine books anywhere by anyone is deplorable. Any freedom of speech which is meant to violate the dignity, values, and religious sanctities of good and God-loving people is not freedom of speech and has no value and is strongly condemned.
Muslim protesters have demanded punishment for the perpetrators, calling for the boycott of Swedish and Danish products.
Representatives of divine religions here believe that branding such moves as acts of democracy and freedom will only further fuel terrorism and extremism across the world, the consequences of which will boomerang on the West before any other side. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Handcuffed and humiliated before her child for the offense she didn't commit. A black woman arrested for what the Metropolitan Police in London suspected was a bus fare evasion. They were wrong. She was released. What ensued? Widespread outrage from the public and politicians. Claudia Webb, MP, said the Met Police is the boot of the state. They do not care about black people and black women in particular. The incident has reignited national conversations about institutional racism and misogyny within the British police force, a force grappling with a crisis of confidence. Revelations of criminals within its ranks, including Wayne Cousins, who abducted, raped, and murdered Sarah Everard as she was walking home nearly 2 years ago, and David Carrick, who admitted to dozens of sexual offenses against 12 women, have shaken faith in the force.
Policing in the UK relies on public consent and trust, but confidence in the police has been in decline in the past few years, especially when it comes to racism against minorities and violence against women and girls. And with the continuing disclosures of members of the police found guilty in those crimes, it's only exposing how deep the problems run.
Of all minority communities, black Britons say they feel the least safe at the hands of British police. The strip search of Child Q, a black 15-year-old girl suspected of having marijuana at a London school in 2020 by two female officers without another adult present, and the police killing of Chris Baba last September, a 24-year-old father and aspiring rapper, are two recent examples.
This case of this young mother with a child is actually symptomatic of the degree of systemic and culturally ingrained racism within the Metropolitan Police Service. And it's a tale that I hear from black mothers all over the city consistently about their unprofessional, violent, and sometimes racist treatment at the hands of them and their children at the hands of the Metropolitan Police Service.
Black children are 11 times more likely to be strip searched in England and Wales than their white peers. And more than half stopped and searched by the police say they were left with feelings of humiliation or embarrassment.
Trauma is a real lived and everyday experience for black people in terms of their relationship with policing, whether it's stop and search, whether it's violent arrest. Again, by the Met's own standards, the Home Office own figures, you're more likely to be stop and search, you're more likely to be violent arrested. And what we find is the trauma that's inflicted on individuals in communities is completely unrecognized and ignored.
Restoring trust would be a massive undertaking. Some are calling for the force to be disbanded in the wake of the recent scandals. Others say the promised overhaul of the UK's entire police culture may be just one step to restore some measure of faith in the force. Saeed Poreza, London.
Votes in the House of Lords, the migration bill is set to become law in the United Kingdom, enabling the Home Office to detain and remove anyone entering the country to seek asylum. They could also be transported to Rwanda or a third country under the plan. the UK struck an initial £140 million agreement with the East African country this year, but the plan has been stuck in the courts. Former British Prime Minister Theresa May has slammed what critics call the Illegal Migration Bill, or IMB, saying it will consign more people to slavery.
It will enable more slave drivers to operate and make money out of human misery. It will consign more people to slavery.
The United Nations has also lambasted the new legislation and warned that it's against international law.
The bill is at variance with the country's obligations under international human rights and refugee law and will have profound consequences for people in need of international protection.
The UN also raised concerns about other countries following suit. UN refugee and human rights experts believe the IMB will exacerbate the already vulnerable situation of refugees across the UK. The No Accommodation Network, which represents a network of over 140 organisations and charities across the UK, called the passing of the bill shameful.
Whilst not unexpected, the passing of the Illegal Migration Bill marks a profoundly shameful and damaging moment for refugee protection and human rights in the UK.
Just hours after the UK passed the controversial bill, a so-called accommodation barge arrived in Portland Port, Dorset. It's due to house 500 asylum seekers, twice the number of people that it was designed for, raising doubts about its safety. It has drawn strong condemnation from different groups and organizations worldwide, with many describing it as a floating prison. Delivering a speech in Westminster, Shadow Home Secretary Yvette Cooper called the new IMB law a con and the use of barges as a sign of the Conservatives' total failure to clear the asylum backlog. A recent poll by YouGov reveals Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's rapidly falling favourability rating, which has sunk to its lowest level to date. In spite of protests and concerns over the anti-refugee plan, the government is adamant that it's the right move. According to official figures, more than 45,000 people were detected arriving by small boats in 2022, 60% higher than in 2021. Now, with the new bill, British authorities have the green light to indiscriminately remove asylum seekers, regardless of whether they are at a risk of persecution, have suffered human rights violations, or are survivors of human trafficking.
The people of Pakistan have held countrywide protests to voice their anger at the recent act of desecration of the Quran in Sweden. In less than a month, an Iraqi refugee in Stockholm committed the sacrilegious act twice while protected by Swedish police. The protesters called on the Islamic world to cut ties with Sweden and to expel its ambassadors from their respective countries.
Muslim nations should jack out a comprehensive line of action to end such sacrilegious acts. We'll continue our fight for the sanctity of our holy book.
In Europe, where you cannot talk about the Holocaust, burning the Quran is freedom of expression. This is the double standard of Europe. Such hate acts should be stopped.
Meanwhile, religio-political groups in Pakistan also demanded cutting off all diplomatic relations with Sweden, while urging the United Nations to legislate against the desecration of holy books, including the Quran.
Quran was desecrated from the second time in Sweden with the permission of the government. What freedom of expression is this? Global colonialist forces are behind this conspiracy, and the anti-Islam actors of Europe are involved in this insult.
While denouncing the incident, Pakistan's Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif pledged to launch a campaign to end the blasphemy of holy books in the Nordic state. He said that his government would help create a common strategy to eliminate Islamophobia with the help of Organization of Islamic Cooperation.
Muslims around the world have been outraged by the repeated desecration of the Holy Quran in Sweden in recent months. They are all in unison that these incidents are blatant provocation, attempting to inflame sentiments and undermine Islam as a religion. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Thousands of people marched and rallied in Seoul Saturday to mark the 70th anniversary of the signing of the Korean War Armistice. They demand a peace treaty with North Korea and view critically the strong ties with the U.S. developing under South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol.
The United States is intervening in our political, diplomatic, military, and economy to maintain and strengthen its hegemony. As a result, the sovereignty of South Korea is being trampled and the national interest is being abandoned.
Previous South Korean President Moon Jae-in had engaged with North Korea and sought to replace the armistice with a peace treaty, but that failed to materialize with the U.S. refusal to respond to Pyongyang's freezing of its nuclear and missile testing.
Relations between North Korea and South Korea and the international community have deteriorated under President Yoon, who's initiated large-scale joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises. The U.S. has also deployed so-called strategic assets to South Korea, weapons capable of delivering a nuclear strike against North Korea, further raising tensions here.
South Koreans here have also been sensitive about the developing trilateral alliance with the U.S. and Japan.
Alliances involve solidarity and equal relationships, not subordination. President Yoon's administration has been increasingly influenced by Japan as well as the United States. The strengthening of the military alliance is very dangerous.
The official armistice anniversary is July 27th. Through this week, various events, including in Washington, D.C., will address replacing the armistice with a peace treaty and seeking better ties with Pyongyang. Frank Smith, Seoul.
After a call by Hezbollah chief Saeed Hassan Nasrallah, Lebanese worshippers took to the streets after noon prayers on Friday to protest the desecration of the Holy Quran.
I demand for the government of the Lebanon to expel the embassy of Sweden for our dignity and prosperity.
Our protest is to defend and secure our Holy Quran and all the holies, starting from hijab, prayers and adhan, and all the holy sites, including the cause and the only cause of all Arab and Muslims, which is the cause. It's certain and the Quran.
We want to defend our Quran and we don't want anyone to violate our holy book.
In a speech on Thursday, the Secretary General of Hezbollah said Hassan Nasrallah denounced the Swedish government for allowing such sacrilegious acts to take place on its territory and stressed that all Arab and Muslim states need to follow in the footsteps of Iraq and expel the Swedish ambassadors.
If all the Arab and Muslim countries withdrew their ambassadors from Sweden and asked the Swedish ambassadors in our countries to leave, then what would happen to Sweden and its government and its interests? Boycotting products is a good step, but it's not enough to teach them a lesson. When they see that their interests are at stake and the Arab and Muslim countries are not too weak to take this step, then they would be forced to resolve this issue.
Nasrallah also called on the Lebanese government to adopt a firm stance against Sweden and asked the worshippers and mourners attending Muharram processions to commemorate the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein to always carry a copy of the Quran to show the world that they are ready to sacrifice their lives for the sake of protecting the holy book.
Today we have gathered to fulfill the call by His Eminence the Secretary General Syed Hassan Nasrallah, who is the great-grandson of Prophet Muhammad, to whom God sent the Quran. We tell Sweden and the entire world that our Quran is Al-Quds. It is our dignity, and we will defend the Quran with all our power until they learn to respect it.
It is our duty to preserve God's religion and the messages He has sent us. To denounce the violation of the Quran, we came here today to say that this is our constitution. And we call on everyone, be they Christian, Druze, Sunni, Shiite, no matter what their sect or their Arab or Muslim nationality, to stand with us.
Several Muslim countries have already summoned Sweden's ambassadors or its charge d'affaires to protest the second incident of state-authorized desecration of the Holy Quran in the Swedish capital.
Lebanese protesters have stressed that the Holy Quran is not only a divine book which introduces Islamic teachings, it is also a book which represents humane values for all mankind. People here today say they are steadfast in defending the Holy Quran against any sacrilegious act. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
Afghan female school graduates are shedding tears of dismay after their exclusion by the Taliban rulers from the university entrance exam, also known as CONCOR. They have been studying hard for the national test in order to pursue higher education. But all that has been in vain, as the Taliban have announced that only male students can sit for the exam this year.
I wanted to pursue my higher education and become a leader and serve my people. But now they say that girls cannot take the university entrance exam. This is unfair and unjust. I am so sad and feel like my life is over.
I wanted to enroll in medical university and become a professional doctor and help my country prosper. But unfortunately, the Taliban shut the doors on our dreams and future and denied us our rights.
In a new report, UN human rights experts say the Taliban authorities have increased restrictions on women and girls in Afghanistan in recent months. The UN has urged the Taliban to respect and protect the rights of all Afghans, especially women and girls, and to ensure their access to education, healthcare, and other essential services.
With all these restrictions on women in place, Afghanistan's future is looking increasingly bleak. Girls and women are losing hope as they are being excluded from all political, social, and educational spheres.
The Taliban have not given any clear indication of when or if girls will be able to resume their studies at high schools or universities. They say they are upholding women's rights in accordance with their interpretation of Sharia law and Afghan culture. No other Muslim country in the world imposes such restrictions on women's education. The fate of Afghan girls remains uncertain as they are being barred from most educational settings. For many of them, education not only is a source of knowledge, but also a source of hope and empowerment. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Imam Hussein in the eyes of Sunni thinkers. Imam Hussein's personality and movement has astounded every seeker of freedom from any creed. Many scholars and intellectuals have spoken about Imam Hussein and the Epic of Ashura during the past 14 centuries. In a few episodes, we have discussed the views of Sunni scholars and Sunni thinkers on this grand personality and his unmatched movement. Stay tuned for the fourth and concluding part of this discussion. Mawlana Muhammad Shafi Diobandi was a Sunni scholar and poet from the Deoband city of Pakistan. Diobandi was born in 1897 and graduated from Darul Uloom, or the House of Sciences, of his city in 1917. Then he started teaching at the same center as the Grand Mufti. This Pakistani Mufti has authored a book on the Epic of Ashura and Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, under the title of Martyr of Karbala. What distinguishes this book from others is the foreword of the book, where he makes it clear that he has collected the content of the book from accurate and documented narrations. Maulana Muhammad Shafi Diobandi, in his book, writes on the role of the wicked rebel Muawiyah, son of Abu Sufyan, in martyrdom of the Holy Prophet's dear grandson, Imam Hussein, peace be upon him. Abdullah, son of Muslim, wrote a letter for Yazid. He said that Imam Hussein's cousin, Muslim ibn Aqil, had come to Kufa to gather people's allegiance for the Imam. Then he continues, "If you need Kufa and wish to have the city in your control, immediately send a powerful and able man to put your rules into action, as the current ruler, Nu'man, son of Bashir, is weak." Maulana Muhammad Shafi Diobandi continues, "Other persons like Amara, son of Walid, and Amr, son of Sa'id, wrote and sent similar letters to Muawiyah's libertine son, Yazid. Yazid, having received those letters, instantly asked for special advisor of his father, Sarjun, son of Mansur, and consulted with him on the circumstances of Kufa. The latter suggested to him to send Ubaidullah, son of Ziyad, to become the ruler of Kufa. Yazid was not in good terms with the son of Ziyad. Thus, Sarjun told him, 'If Muawiyah was here and asking you to do something, would you do it?' Yazid answered, 'Surely I would have done it.' Then Sarjun took out a letter from the rebel Muawiyah in which he had appointed Ubaidullah, son of Ziyad, as the ruler of Kufa. Therefore Yazid accepted and appointed the son of Ziyad, Ubaidullah, as the ruler of both Kufa and Basra. He stressed that he should leave for Kufa as soon as getting the letter. He ordered him to arrest and kill Imam Hussein's cousin and emissary, Muslim ibn Aqil." Sunni Muslims consider Imam Hussein's martyrdom as a picture of valor, self-sacrifice, defense of truth, and fighting oppressors. Maulana Muhammad Shafi Diobandi writes in his book on Imam Hussein's valor in the heat of the battle, "Shemr, son of Zeljoshan, attacked Imam Hussein with 10 men." Dear listeners, what many historians and narrators have said is that hundreds of top commanders of the enemy assaulted the Imam, and the Imam killed all of them. Yet, Muhammad Shafi Diobandi has written only 10 men attacked him. He continues, "The Imam, in spite of innumerable wounds and excessive thirst, fought them bravely. Historians have written that this event was unique, as Hussein ibn Ali, peace be upon him, fought steadfastly and courageously, despite having sustained too many injuries. Wherever Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, turned, the enemy would immediately escape. Thus, Shemr understood that Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, could not be killed except through besieging him and attacking from every side. So the troops attacked him ferociously and martyred the grandson of the Holy Prophet."
the wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The supply of cluster munitions to Kyiv is complicating the situation of Ukraine conflict. In the latest development, the governor of Russia's Belgorod region said Ukraine fired cluster munitions at a village near the Ukrainian border on Friday. Governor Vyacheslav Gladkov said three cluster munitions and more than 20 artillery shells were fired at the village of Zhuravlevka. In a separate incident, Russian journalist Rostislav Zhuravlev was killed on Saturday in Ukraine's southeastern Zaporizhia region.
On July the 22nd, 2023, AFU units launched an artillery strike on a group of journalists from the Izvestia and the RIA Novosti news agencies. As a result of the strike with cluster munitions, four journalists were wounded to varying degrees of severity. During the evacuation, a journalist from the RIA Novosti news agency died from his injuries.
Reacting to the deadly assault, Russia's deputy ambassador to the United Nations said the attack had crossed all moral red lines. In a separate reaction, the Russian foreign ministry described Zhuravlev's death as a heinous premeditated crime committed by Western powers in Kyiv. Russia's foreign ministry spokesman Maria Zakharova denounced what she called criminal terror, adding that the attack appeared deliberate. Russia's investigative committee said it had launched a criminal probe into the killing of the journalist. It said that as part of the investigation, investigators will establish all the circumstances of the crime against media representatives as well as those involved. The reactions come as Ukraine received cluster bombs from the United States earlier this month. Kyiv repeatedly said the use of cluster munitions will be limited to the battlefield, pledging that it will use them only to dislodge